All right, let's get started. My name is Sean Lindsay. I'm delighted to be joined this afternoon by Greg Woodhouse, Stacy Kilpak, and Kim Sika. We are here to talk about, to present the first Dharma talk of the, call it a virtual Sangha, virtual refuge Sangha. We're still working on the name. And today's kind of an auspicious day to kick off the Dharma talks, as it's the day Tibetan Buddhists commemorate as the birthday of the Buddha. As the traditional stories go, Siddhartha Gautama was born, was enlightened, and died on the same day of the year. So if you lean Tibetan, happy Buddha's birthday. Despite the celebration of the day, and maybe in a kind of deeper respect of it, today we're going to talk about doing something that makes little sense to most normal people. I thought I'd title today's discussion, Turning Towards Suffering. Normal people turn away from suffering just as they steer their cars around potholes in the road. If you're normal, you ask, why on earth would we ever want to turn towards suffering? Don't we have enough to deal with already? Why give it more stage time? I have a dear friend who has a profoundly disabled daughter. During her pregnancy, a virus infected and destroyed much of her daughter's brain. But she was born nonetheless and survived the birth. My friend has written of the stunning reaction she still gets from almost all medical professionals within a few minutes of meeting her and seeing her daughter. Essentially, they ask, when are you going to let her die? They are so uncomfortable, so incapacitated, they are rendered so irrelevant by the situation that rather than turning towards their own suffering and acknowledging it, they project their ego's revulsion at their own inability to help, at its own irrelevance, and they immediately assume they know better than the mother who successfully cared for her daughter for more than 20 years. They don't ask how she taught her daughter to swallow. They don't ask what foods work best for her. They don't ask how she even communicates with her daughter. They see the daughter, and they want her to die. And they don't ever admit to themselves that by failing to confront their own suffering, they're actually creating conditions for more suffering. Alienation, isolation, rejection, pain, loss, stress, you name it. And this is from people who devote their lives to medically helping others, people who are among the best of us when it comes to altruism. So when I think of why turning towards suffering, a lot of answers come to mind. One answer is this: until we acknowledge and can look directly at the problem, the dis-ease, which is where the word disease comes from, the dis-ease of suffering, the chances of us actually addressing it are effectively pretty close to zero. Another answer might be this: until we thoroughly know the nature and structure and contours of our own suffering, it's like a monster under the bed. Fearing and avoiding it causes more harm and requires more energy than actually confronting it does. For some of us, it starts to dawn on us that we're actually causing the suffering that we experience. The Sufi Muslim tradition has a take on this as well, but from a more humorous perspective. Their point is, so long as we seek liberation by trying to avoid suffering, we're just looking in the wrong place. You may have heard stories before of the wise fool Mullah Nasruddin. As one story goes, one evening he's searching through the grass by the side of the road under a street lamp. His friend comes up to him and asks, "What are you looking for?" And Nasruddin says, "I lost my keys." So they both look and look and look, and without any success, finally his friend asks, "Where exactly did you lose the keys?" And Nasruddin points down the way down the road into the darkness and says, "Over there." "Why are you looking for them here?" his friend asks. "Because the light's better here," he answers. Sometimes turning away from suffering while looking for freedom from suffering is like hunting for your keys under the street lamp where the light is better, even though you lost them over in the field in the dark. In the context of my friend's experience with the doctors reacting to her daughter's condition, Buddhist teaching and recent neuroimaging studies suggest another reason to turn towards our own experiences of suffering. They teach us that until we stop trying to avoid suffering in our own lives, stop the mind's tendency towards seeking distraction, seeking to blame, seeking to rationalize, seeking to protect ourselves from our own experience, until we bring that process to an end, we will be less effective at acknowledging and addressing it, the suffering, in the lives of others. When the Buddha first began teaching following his awakening, the first thing he taught to his students was to turn towards suffering, to acknowledge hard facts of life. His students had trained in concentration meditation practices, practices that can be very important and, if pursued diligently, can lead to really unbelievably beautiful mind states. But those states last only as long as the meditation lasts. With this first teaching, the Buddha was pointing out the defect in thinking that such practices lead to ultimate freedom. When we come out of those beautiful mind states, life still entails suffering. and we've accomplished nothing more but more deeply ingraining our avoidance strategies. So the first thing he taught them was to turn towards suffering. Modern neuroimaging, I mentioned, is still at an early age of development, but one of the things that fascinates me about the accounts that I've heard from Richie Davidson, is one of the researchers in this area, is that they've discovered that sets of neurons that are activated when we directly and intentionally experience our own suffering are the very same ones that are activated when we experience compassion for other people who are suffering. Now, consider the implications of that for a minute. To the extent that we practice mind patterns, building neural patterns, right? The subjective mind experience aligns with the physical neural constructs inside the brain. So to the extent we practice mind patterns and build neural patterns of avoiding thinking about our own suffering, those same systems steer our mind away from acknowledging others' suffering. It's not that we decide not to be compassionate. It's that the very structure of our minds are such that compassion circuits never get activated. So compassion for others grows and flowers much more easily in gardens dug and watered by our own suffering and tears. As long as we turn away from our own sources of suffering, we're more habituated to turning away from other people's suffering as well. Now, as I started to think about preparing this discussion, when you start thinking about ways that life and experience includes, it's not solely defined by, but once you start thinking about the way that life includes suffering, a lot of ideas come to mind. Antagonistic family members, stubborn bosses, rigid religious leaders, ungrateful children, abusive parents. Those are the ones that hurt a lot in relationships. But sometimes what causes suffering or what we experience as suffering is a lot less significant. Arthritic wrists or malfunctioning internal organs or bad knees or balding scalps or athlete's foot. Sometimes in a political realm, it's Democrats running amok or Republicans running amok. When it comes to mind states, it's depression, it's OCD, it's PMS, it's PTSD, it's bipolar disorder. When it comes to the way we look at ourselves in the mirror, it's tan lines and wrinkles and Botox paralysis. And when we listen to the radio, it's Muzak and gangsta rap and Air Supply, especially Air Supply. When you open the fridge, it's sour milk and mushy bananas and dry pot roast. When you think more abstractly about food, it's those obnoxious vegans, or the carnivores, or PETA, or the NRA, or cactus spines, or bee stings, or mosquito bites. Recently, among some of my closer relationships, it's been cerebral aneurysms, stage 4 ovarian cancer, oxycodone overdoses, diabetes. And throughout all of our lives, it's discrimination, it's sexism, it's racism, it's hunger, it's thirst, it's prosecution, it's striking you on your right cheek, it's stealing your cloak, it's slavery, compulsion, coercion, imprisonment. The list goes on and on. We can add to it the central experiences that are common to almost all of us are of loneliness, boredom, anger, greed, covetousness, restlessness, lethargy, and delusion. Have I missed any? I'm certain that I did. So when you build your list, add them to yours, really. What I'm urging you to do is turn toward every single one of them. And when you get really, really tired of seeing all that suffering, see the being tired of suffering as another form of suffering. It's another form. It's really there. There's something that every one of those kinds of suffering does have in common, and it's that you're looking for. If you see that and address that, you might be onto something important. What you're looking for is to see the mind actually engaging in the avoidance patterns. It's feeling the subtle sensation of the mind wanting to turn away from a moment's experience. Sometimes turning towards our own suffering can be the greatest expression of courage that there can be. I'm reminded of the common observation that courage isn't being fearless. Rather, it's turning toward what we fear toward what we fear the most while we're experiencing the fear. Turning towards suffering, allowing ourselves to actually feel discomfort and dissatisfaction and anger and frustration and disappointment and sadness and depression, actually allowing all those emotions the space to arise and to exist without turning away from them, without trying to distract ourselves, without trying to dull our senses with chemicals or substances, without trying to curtail the experience, that very turning toward is the work. We are so deeply ingrained to avoid such things that we could go through life never seeing what good can come from directly confronting experience itself. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's a great book called Freedom in the Family, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights by Patricia Stevens Due. She tells a story. She was one of the activists of that very first jail-in and protest to sit on the lunch counters of Woolworth because Woolworths were segregating their diners. She wrote this, which kind of captures some of this, I think, pretty usefully. She says, I mentioned that some of our jailers were verbally abusive toward us, but one was simply professional, neither more or less. Only days before we were to leave that jail, the tall, mature-looking man, whose name I don't know, unexpectedly showed up carrying a young boy, perhaps as young as 3 or 4. Since whites had been restricted from seeing us, it was a shock to see the jailer bringing a white child that young. Once they were closer, we could tell from their resemblance that the boy must be his son. The jailer stood in front of the cell with his son on his arm, and the boy leaned his tiny face through the bars of our cell to gaze at us. I braced for the worst, imagining that he was about to sow the seeds of racism into the next generation. The jailer began to speak, pointing us out one by one. Now, these ladies are sisters, Priscilla Stevens and Patricia Stevens, and the other lady here is Barbara Broxton. Say hello to them. Hi, the boy said obediently. I know your daddy has told you that only bad people go to jail. Well, you may be too young to understand, but these ladies aren't in jail because they are crooks or because they are bad people. They are in jail because they are trying to change the laws that say blacks and whites can't eat together. They want to be treated just like everyone else, and they believe in what they are doing so much that they are willing to go to jail to make it right. So you remember that, okay? One day you'll look back and realize how important it was for them to do this. The boy nodded soberly. Perhaps he understood, and perhaps he didn't. But that jailer couldn't have given a greater gift to those behind bars, nor to his son. That was Patricia Stevens. The example, though, I thought was perfect for this discussion, because turning towards suffering can be as simple as sitting at a lunch counter where you're not welcome and you know it, but going there anyway, not avoiding it. Or turning towards suffering can be as simple as allowing your child to see with his own eyes a truth that your first instinct might have been to shield him away from. Never to admit to him that you were a jailer of civil rights protesters. But this one provides a great example, at least for me, of both the people who are in jail as well as the jailer. Both were in uncomfortable situations. Both took them head on and decided to dive in rather than to avoid. So what happens when we turn our minds toward an honest reflection on the nature of suffering? Why are we doing this? I think for this reason, because we encounter a fuller experience of our own life. If we turn towards suffering and face it directly, we do allow ourselves to experience things that are more terrible, more distressing, more uncomfortable, more embarrassing, more disturbing, more appalling, more concerning. And the way we do that is by looking at our existence with fewer and fewer preconceptions, fewer and fewer filters, fewer mind tricks that as we start to notice what's going on, we see our own mind turning away from things, and allow ourselves fewer shutdown triggers. Okay, I've had enough. I'm just not going to look at that any longer. I'm not going to pay attention to that. I'm going to do something else. So fewer preconceptions and filters, but it also means we experience things with more sensory awareness, more perception, more openness. And one of the consequences of living in that way is not only more experience with suffering, but also more experience with everything, more beauty, more happiness, more joy, more peace, more love, more kindness, and, as we've already mentioned, more compassion. So how do we practice it? Where do we start? My favorite way in, those of you who know me best will already maybe chuckle at this, my favorite way in is via physical discomfort. I'm a very physical critter. I like sensations, and I orient to them. It's no surprise that the church that I currently attend found my true calling. It was to put me with the 2-year-olds so I could sit on the floor and play blocks. So one of the tricky parts about allowing myself to experience suffering without automatically turning toward avoidance mechanisms is that physical pain is usually, or at least was evolutionarily, a signal of danger to my body or danger to the organism. But it's wildly overprotective. So one really useful practice for me is to find some unpleasant sensation that I know intellectually really isn't a signal that I need to do something immediately to keep myself from dying. And so my favorite one is this. When I find myself in a place with mosquitoes, I allow a mosquito to land on my arm or my hand, some part of my body that I can see. And rather than swatting it or brushing it off, I watch it pick a spot, drill into my skin, draw my blood, engorge itself. And I have to wear reading glasses to watch it engorge itself. I'm too old and my eyes are too dim. But then what's really kind of funny is watching this overfull mosquito fly off of my arm, kind of drunkenly off into the sky. But my mind is so programmed to react with avoidance behavior at every step in that process that it's terrifically instructive to intentionally hold my mind and body still, watch the ingrained reactions arise, and then watch them subside. And then with an itchy little welt on my arm or leg, I watch the urge to scratch it arrive. And I watch the urge to put salve on it or some itch cream or whatever. And when I don't respond to those urges either, without trying to shut down the urges, just to bring them to awareness and watch them and learn, it's that the experience that is transformative. If you're not allergic to bee stings, then getting stung by a bee can be even a better opportunity because it hurts more. If you're allergic to bees, this is a terrible idea. But I recently did it a couple of months ago with a bee sting, and it was incredible. I didn't let the bee – I didn't watch the bee sting me. I managed to get stung by my own incompetence around the bees. But once I got stung by a bee, I knew I wasn't going to die, and so I watched the bee sting experience develop. I watched the pain. I watched my mind thinking, gadzooks, I must find a way out of this. At any rate, if your experience is anything like mine, once you find a single simple way to start practicing with this, what you'll find is more and more and more opportunities to practice. They won't be all mosquitoes or bee stings, but you'll start to see the ways that you are turning away from suffering. And if that happens to you, I'd like to give you the reassurance that of my own experience, that it's not that you're actually suffering more, it's that you're noticing you're suffering more, and you're shifting from automatic subconscious responses to suffering to a conscious awareness of the opportunities to respond differently. An event from several decades ago in my own life. I had been an impoverished college student and didn't mind it. I went to graduate school thinking I was going to be an English professor, and I found graduate school was very difficult for me, terrible in terms of career planning, and so I promptly switched over to law school. And between the between the first and second years of law school, I got a job downtown Chicago working for a law firm. For a person at my level at that point in life, it was a dream job. And so I'm walking down a busy Chicago street in the financial district, middle of summer. It's a bright, clear, sunny day. I was doing research for a law firm. I was kind of on the top of my world at that point. I was finally earning some money. I had a job with a good law firm. I was excited about life. I was caught up in the peculiarity of having a degree of success after years and years of uncertainty. So I ventured out of the office at lunch one day to get to grab a sandwich at a nearby deli. And I got to a really busy intersection, and I waited for the light to change so I could cross the street. This was the 1980s, and so I was surrounded by dark gray and navy pinstripe suits, both men and women, because it was the 1980s, so everyone wore power suits. And there were all these well-dressed people who seemed to me to be about 5 years closer than I was to the goals I imagined that we were all pursuing. We were all successful. That was what that part of town was all about. So the light changed, and the crowds waiting on either side of the crosswalk converged. Some person moving a bit more slowly than made sense in my caffeinated power broker fantasy. And a couple of more glimpses, and I saw that the person was a woman, and ahead, I could see that the crowd was parting slightly to flow past her on either side. She was barefoot, wearing filthy Levi's. A gray long-sleeve shirt that through the glimpses I could catch seemed kind of flowing. The street-crossing crowd shifted, and suddenly I found myself face-to-face with the woman. Her face was heavily lined and creased. It bore the look of someone bereft of connection, bereft of community, maybe a drug addict, maybe a homeless person. I glanced down to see what had caught my attention about her shirt. It wasn't some flowing design. It was simply unbuttoned. Her dirty torso and sagging breasts were exposed and uncared for. Every single person in the crowd, seeing her, simply stepped to one side or the other and kept moving past. Kind of guaranteeing her isolation in the midst of thousands of people like water flowing around a boulder in the river. And I was no different. I stepped to her right, never turned back. But I've remembered that instant and that image for the last 25 years of my life. In response to my mind's perception of her mental illness and my attachments to the world I barely entered, I experienced an unsettling, disturbing discomfort, suffering, in a word, that might at that point have begun me had I followed it along the path of illumination, but I turned away from the suffering that moment caused me, and I turned away from that woman's suffering. We do turn away. We pretend not to see. Sometimes it's to protect ourselves from our own experience. Sometimes it's to protect ourselves from other people's experience. Sometimes we persuade ourselves that turning away is really to protect others from our reminding them of their experience, as if they wouldn't notice if we didn't point it out to them. Have you ever encountered somebody who was mentally ill? A person in your church or synagogue who talked to people who weren't there, who didn't dress normally, or who talked at inappropriate times about inappropriate things? Or maybe someone who simply lost their temper beyond any concept of normality? If you did, maybe at some point and in some way you turned away from that person or from that experience. Siddhartha Gautama, the guy we call the Buddha these days, 2,500 years ago, was of course lived in a different time and a different culture, but not a different world altogether. As the traditional stories go about his early life, he lived a pampered and sheltered existence. And when he was in his late 20s, he managed to escape the confines of the compound where he was being raised and groomed, ex-tribe. And once he got outside of the gates, he encountered for the first time a person who was old and decrepit. He encountered a person who was diseased and sick. He saw a corpse decomposing by the side of the road. And he was profoundly moved. He turned toward those experiences that others had sheltered him from for so many years. And he saw what they had to teach him about the illusions he'd been living with. In short, he saw my homeless woman in the financial district of Chicago, but rather than turning away from her, he saw what she meant to the world he'd constructed in his head. But seeing those three things, and then seeing a peace-filled, calm, equanimous monk, Siddhartha Gautama started down the path that led to awakening, to the end of suffering, not the end of pain, not the end of conflict, not the end of physical infirmity, not the end of birth or life or death, but the end of suffering in the midst of those changing, unconstant events. And though he didn't find a straight path from the moment he turned toward suffering, by his own account, he describes mistakes and U-turns and abandonments and alienations along that path. Though it wasn't a straight line for him, it began, as it has to begin for each of us, by turning toward suffering rather than turning away again and again and again. It's not really a propositional truth of suffering. It's more of an insight. If you turn away, you'll continue suffering, both your own and that of those around you. If you fully and thoroughly understand your suffering, be realistic about it, set aside the stories. The insight of the Buddha is the recognition of the value of turning towards suffering. That turning towards is an ennobling act. It becomes when the Buddha formulated his experience into memorizable phrases, what he said was the first noble truth, which is that experiencing life entails suffering. Holding suffering in this fashion enables the other practices that comprise the path. So that's the very short gist of what we're here to talk about today. Has there been a time in your life when you went against your ingrained instincts and turned towards your suffering rather than away from it? Or have there been times when you turned away from suffering that you only had to turn back to later on in your lives? I'd like your thoughts. Any volunteers?
This is Stacy. For me, gosh, it's giving me so much to think about what you're saying here. But, you know, I had kind of a traumatic experience when I was young. My mom became very ill when I was 8 years old. And I didn't have the skill set to turn towards it. I didn't even know what that meant, probably. And I avoided it even for years. For all of my life. But what I found is that our pain waits for us. I did have to face it, and it was empowering when I finally did.
Yeah, the kinds of things that happen to us when we're very young, and we don't, it's not that there's anything wrong with being young and experiencing pain and suffering. It's that we don't have the tools to know how to deal with it skillfully. Sometimes we get lucky and we hit on the right formula, or sometimes we have a person who helps steer us through it. But often enough, we avoid it because we don't have any other technology or technique to know how to manage it. Sometimes when we turn towards suffering, we can get pathological about it. we can turn into a victim. You know, in one way, victim mentality is exactly turning towards suffering and seeing only suffering. Are there ways to avoid those kinds of mind traps?
That's a good question. How do you do that? What's the difference? Because nobody wants to be a victim. So sometimes you feel like if you really, I think maybe that's part of the fear of turning towards suffering. Are you going to be a victim? Are you going to be that person that, you know, walks around feeling sorry for themselves, suffering? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I've certainly experienced that in my own life. And in fact, for a number of years, my experience was defined in some regards by ways in which I was a victim. And it's kind of tricky because you need to find a way, a path. I'm not sure that there's one path through and away from the victim story. In some regards, you need to be honest with yourself and you need to give yourself a break. For many years, it's easy to say, it's easy to say that person should get over it. You know, they've played the victim for long enough. They ought to see their way out of that forest or in particular right now. But it often isn't that easy. There's some things that have to be lived into, in order to, be able to be free of them, I think. And sometimes, a victim story itself is a shield from the experience and from taking responsibility for the pieces of the story that we are responsible for. Greg, Kim, do you have thoughts?
This is Kim. Had an experience recently. I have people in my life who tend to push my buttons and then they find the need to correct me as though I'm, you know, a kid still. And I had an epiphany recently that said, well, I can either get upset about it and say, oh, I did something wrong again, or take it under advisement, go about my normal day, and then change the behavior next time. So it was kind of usually I would just, oh, feel sorry for myself, oh, poor me. But now it's, okay, well, I have the choice here. I could either get sad and whatever, or deal with it and move on. And then I end up having a better day as a result. So it works out better.
What was the thing that turned your experience into something that you were free from and rather than being the story that defined you, Kim?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. I guess one day I said, I'm tired of this. It just, I realized that I was causing it. So I basically said to myself, stop it. And it doesn't always work, of course, but, sometimes better than others. But I noticed once I come out the other side, once I haven't done that, I thought, huh, I made myself stop it this time. It's kind of liberating in a way.
I think there really is something to seeing the story as a story and going, oh, I'm going into my story again.
Yeah, and it seems to be the same story repeating, regardless of the trigger.
That's an interesting experience. Greg, do you have experiences here you'd like to share?
Well, I'm just thinking what would the opposite be. The opposite might be to think that through our own efforts or through our own life choices, we can somehow avoid the problems in the world. You know, like practicing law, getting a good job or whatever. I say, oh, well, that woman up there, she's not me. I'm pursuing my career and I'm got a good job and things are going to be okay. And I think that at some point, I guess we have to recognize that, you know, there are bad things that happen to everyone and working harder is not the answer or getting a good job is not an answer.
Yeah, for me, I think what resonates with that insight, Greg, is the increase in compassion that starts to happen as I recognize suffering in my own life. It's taken me 25 years to connect my own experience of suffering with that stark memory of the woman in the financial district of Chicago 25 years ago. And so I'm not saying that it's a fast process by any stretch of the imagination, But I've gone through enough life at this point that I've experienced enough suffering, frankly. And I've acknowledged to myself enough suffering that I can suddenly say, oh, you know, I'm not saying that if I'd been some fabulously self-aware creature at the time that I encountered her, that I would have known what the right solution was to her problems. It's a bit presumptuous even to think that I, as a 25-year-old kid, would have any clue about what that woman actually needed. But the fact is I turned her off. I shut her out. I stepped to the side of her and kept going. And it took me decades, literally, to reconnect enough with my experience to feel some degree of compassion towards her. Compassion is only the first step in the process, though, right? It's the part that says, I'm going to allow myself to experience discomfort because you're experiencing discomfort. It's not some kind of weird empathy that suddenly allows us to take on all the suffering of somebody else. That's just incapacitating. And frankly, it's rather unskillful. If one person is having a panic attack, it doesn't help if the next person in the seat next to them says, oh, they're having a panic attack. I need to join them.
Right.
You have a whole airplane full of people who are having panic attacks. That isn't the objective of compassion. But compassion Compassion allows us to feel another's suffering. And feeling another's suffering sometimes can be the impetus to bring us outside of ourselves. Have you all ever heard the story of Kiso Gotami? I wasn't planning on telling the story today, but maybe it'd be worthwhile.
No, I've never heard it.
So this is another one of those stories that give Buddhist teachings a reputation for being dark and grim. But quoted enough in enough different accounts that it either was a well-invented, fabricated story or it actually happened. So Kiso Gotami, Gotami is like Gotama, right? It means that she was in the same clan as Siddhartha, who is the Buddha. Kiso Gotami, this is after his enlightenment and he's known as the Buddha. She is a woman in a lower caste in Indian society and she marries above her station. And so she doesn't have very many friends in Indian society, and they kind of look down on her. But then she gives birth to a son. And in the society where she grew up, giving birth to a son itself conveyed status. And so she became a fairly important person because she gave birth to a son. But the son at 6 weeks old died. And she was bereft, and she went back to being a nobody in her community. But she wouldn't put the child's body to the cremation ground. She carried him around believing that he was only sick and not dead. And her friends realized that she had in some ways lost part of her mind. And they finally said, well, go to the Buddha. The Buddha can help you. And so she goes to the Buddha and says, I need medicine for my son. He's sick. And the Buddha probably knew her because she was part of his clan. But at any rate, he said, he realized that if he told her that her son was dead, that she would be stuck in her delusion and suffer more without ever learning anything. And so what he told her is, there is medicine that can help, but what you need to do for the medicine is to go to each house in the village and gather a mustard seed from them, but you can only receive the mustard seeds from the household that has never experienced death. And so mustard seeds are as common in Indian cooking as salt and pepper are in the United States. And so the story goes, Kiso Gotami goes to each household in the village. Oh, do you have mustard seeds that I can have? Oh, yes, we have lots of mustard seeds. You're welcome to them. Oh, but I can't take any mustard seeds from you if you've ever had anybody in your household die. And then the people look kind of crestfallen and say, Kiso, it's not just one person that's died in this household. We lived here for generations. There are tens and dozens of people that have died in this house. So she goes to the next one. And the next one, and the next one. And she visits all of the homes in the village, and so it dawns on her that death and suffering is the common experience of everyone. And as she realizes that, the story goes, it allowed her to realize that her son had died as well. And she took him to the cremation grounds, and he was cremated. And as the story goes, Kiso Gotami, these stories always turn out this way, right? Kiso Gotami becomes a disciple of the Buddha, and becomes fully awakened because she was able to turn toward her own suffering and confront it. But not until, for her, the way in was the other way around. It wasn't seeing her own suffering and allowing it to, that to enable her to see other people's suffering. It was realizing other people's suffering in order to allow herself to see her own. So long story short, sometimes these practices lead us into compassion. And I think that's the connecting part, Greg, that brings us back, that prevents Sean from walking down the street now and seeing a street person and thinking, well, I've got a safe job. I'm economically secure. These people don't touch me, and so I can't, I don't feel for them. The more we suffer and the more we allow ourselves to be open to suffering, I think the more we end up connected to everybody around us. You have thoughts on that regard, any, Stacy or Kimberly?
I have a question rather than a thought.
Cool, fire away.
If you were to encounter that same woman today, how would your response be different internally and externally? Would you approach her, or is it your thought pattern that would be different?
You know, I've reflected on that question about 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, arrows in my quiver now than I had when I was 25, 26. Now, if I were confronted with that situation, it might be that the woman would had no interest in being talked to by somebody dressed in a power suit walking back and forth on the streets of Chicago. But I'd at least meet her eyes, and I'd ask her, can I help you? Can I help you find lunch? Can I help you find shelter? And she might push me off. She might swear at me. She might take a poke at my face. But I also, if I don't feel like that's going to be a successful approach, and different personalities differ that way, right? Some people are perfectly comfortable approaching strangers and some people aren't. If I wasn't able to approach her that way, I might find a way to connect with the homeless shelters in the Chicago area. And I might find ways to improve life that way. Or I might just take it inside and allow myself to say, the world I'm living in, this suit of power suits and upward climbing, young, upwardly mobile professionals, I think was the phrase, right? Yuppies. This world I'm walking in is an illusion. And so there's a lot of different things that could happen if I were willing to let myself open to that suffering. Some of them might help the woman's situation. Some of them candidly might not. But all of them would have helped the situation that existed between her and me, even if it didn't help me in particular, or even if it didn't help her in particular. So once we allow ourselves to experience all the things that we're turning away from, what happens is they become wildly unpredictable. What happens is we start to notice little tiny details that maybe steer us in one direction or cause us to ask a question that we would never in a million years have thought to ask because we didn't notice those details as we were spending so much time adroitly trying to avoid even thinking about the situation at all. This happened to me as a parent a lot, a parent of young children. When my kids, if we first got kids, there was no instruction manual. I had no idea what I was doing. And my children would start screaming, and it's like, oh, I could turn away and think, well, he'll just have to get over it. Or I could turn toward it angrily and try and deal with it with anger. But when I'm angry, I don't notice details either. It was only when I turned toward the situation and thought, huh, I got to find a solution to this, to be more concrete about it. My first child, or our first child, when he was born, had colic. From about 3 p.m. in the afternoon until about 6 p.m. in the evening, for most of the first four months of his life, he screamed. He wailed. There was nothing that I could figure out to do. I tried being angry. I tried yelling at a newborn. Really, Sean? Yelling? Yes, I tried yelling. I'm not a success. I tried responding with anger. I tried ignoring him, putting him in his crib and just going into the other room. And in none of those ways did I pick up on any cues from him because I was trying to turn away from it. It was only when I finally got I began to think of him as a defective instrument, and I thought, I wonder what is going on in his little head. And it was only with that much that's a pretty dispassionate and a pretty heartless approach to him, but at least I was turning toward him rather than away from him. And when I turned toward him that much, I realized that he was still responding to sounds in the room, even though he was crying. And so then I turned up the stereo, and I happened to like metal music at that point in my life. And so the stereo was playing loud, clashy metal music. And when I got the stereo up loud enough that he could hear it over his own screaming, sometimes he'd stop and listen to it. If I turned the volume down, he'd go back to screaming again. I'm not saying that playing heavy metal music for your newborn infant while he has colic is a particularly skillful way of dealing with him. But I offer that to answer your question, Kim. How might I have dealt with the woman in Chicago? I haven't any idea. I hope I would have picked up on the details of the situation that, frankly, I don't have at my command today because I didn't turn toward her and I didn't learn those details. So I don't know how I would have responded. I know that when I do turn toward suffering, I tend to notice things that I wouldn't otherwise see.
Fair enough.
Other thoughts or questions or comments, contributions?
Go ahead, Greg.
I was just going to suggest that maybe there are problems that we can't solve. At least, I know I had similar experiences when I worked in San Francisco and in Oakland, and tried some of the same things that you talked about. Ultimately, you know, I guess I realized that, you know, if someone comes to you and gives you in a situation where you can help them, that's great, but those situations may not always present themselves. And I've really struggled with, well, what do you do? Do you approach them with ideas like homeless shelters, or do you just say hello to them? On the other hand, I know I've tried to stop and talk to somebody, and they follow me into a restaurant and wouldn't leave me alone. Or on the other hand.
Yeah, that happens.
It's all very frustrating.
I think what the right answer is in any given situation is kind of an illusion. It's an illusion to think that there's a right answer, that if I only have the right answer, I could suddenly turn this person's entire lifetime of bad karma, bad suffering, and bad responses to suffering, drug addiction, you know, whatever. I can turn the key and everything will make – it will be a net improvement in this person's life. I think it's a delusion to think that always happens. It does happen every now and again, and so you start to think, oh, there must be an answer for everybody. I'm not sure that there actually is, but I know that we want there to be. And I know that we want there to be because we want to diminish suffering. And sometimes wanting to diminish suffering, well, it's not a bad thing. Sometimes we can get attached to it, and then we can turn it into a yet another mind trick to reinforce our own egos. Sometimes the answer is Sean Lindsay doesn't have the key for somebody else's problem. As much as I might want a world where there is a key for everybody's problem, sometimes I'm not going to have it. Doesn't mean that I quit trying, that I quit paying attention. But it does mean that sometimes suffering is just suffering. Does that help, or is your experience different than that, Greg?
No, I think you're right. It's not a very satisfying answer, but it may not mean that it's not true.
Okay. Stacy, did you have something you wanted to share?
You know, my thought/question kind of went along with what Greg was saying. I'm just wondering, is part of this, am I understanding this? And that turning towards suffering, it's not the end of pain or conflict, as you said. It's more just the end of suffering. Does this just mean that we just need to be more in the moment, embracing the moment? Does the peace come from knowing that we don't have to fix everything, that it's okay to just feel things? Is it that simple?
I think what happens on the path to liberation is that we realize that our desires – I need to find the right way to say this – that sometimes experiencing pain and discomfort, watching a mosquito suck your blood, watching a bee sting feel incredibly painful. Sometimes if we stop the avoidance strategies and just allow the experience to exist, we discover that we can, it's not that we're free from pain, it's that we can be free in pain. The mind can be at peace even if the mind, the body is experiencing intense pain or emotional discomfort or, another example from my ill-starred past of working in corporate America. At one point in my career, I was working with some financial experts, and we were trying to measure the potential exposure of a particular risk that was facing the company I was working for. And I was working with these experts because the numbers we were talking were in the billions of dollars. And so we were estimating that it was, I don't remember how many billion, let's say $3 billion was the exposure that we of the model we'd come up with. And the company had relied on our calculations and advice to put those figures into their published financial statements. And I get this phone call one afternoon from the financial experts and they say, "Sean, we think we made a mistake. The exposure wasn't whatever we were estimating, $3 billion, it was $6 billion. And I remember feeling my stomach drop all the way to the floor and think, we already put $3 billion into our financial statements. And so this is never going to turn out very well. So I said, okay, I need you guys to go back over your numbers because I need you to be able to explain to me exactly where we made our mistake and how we did the math wrong. And then I went outside and I walked around my building and I thought, okay, I need to be able to explain to people where the numbers came from. My career, by the way, is completely over. The only thing I was responsible for was evaluating this risk and managing it, and it appears that I missed it by a factor of two. and I felt myself tense. I felt myself horrified. I felt myself twisted, and I realized, oh wait, I don't need to turn away from those experiences. This is just what the world is like. This is what my world is right now. My world is the fact that I have so colossally fouled up that I underestimated an exposure by $3 billion. And the company's financials are reflected in that. The stock price is reflected in that calculation. Everything is going to be different once we figure this out. And I finished my walk around the block and I thought, oh, I'm capable of thinking even in this moment. Even though not thinking clearly, it wasn't an improvement in the situation, but my attitude towards it completely changed. And I was free within that moment to experience what was going on. And I still remember that even though my world had fallen away, the sun was shining. I remember feeling the sensation of a breeze on my cheek. In short, I was experiencing life in that very moment, even though everything that I'd spent 20 years on building a professional career out of had fallen apart around me. Now, as sometimes stories work out, I went back up and called the experts back and they went, oh, we made a mistake. We multiplied by two instead of dividing by two. it all came back together. And it turns out I still am employed by, not by the same company, but by I'm still employed, period. Maybe I should be celebrating. I couldn't have fixed that situation in the middle of it, but I can be free while in the middle of it. And that's kind of a cool discovery, because once we realize that we can be free in terrible situations, we can also be free in pleasant situations, not to get attached to a particular outcome. And while the path that the Buddha described is a path that takes us very much farther than simply allowing ourselves to experience what's going on in the very moment, that's one of the huge benefits of it. That's the kind of the cherry on top of the sundae. Because just as we allow ourselves to experience more suffering, we simultaneously allow ourselves to experience more joy. And maybe that's the answer. I hadn't thought of it in these terms before, but maybe that's the answer to victim mentality. If we're turning, in order to remain victim, in order to focus only on the negative that we're suffering, we have to really continue to ignore what's good that's going on at the same time. And so what we ought to be focusing on is turning towards experience. Turning towards suffering is maybe a good title for most of us in Western culture who are acclimated towards improving our circumstances and avoiding unpleasantness. But for those of us that have had experiences that turned us into toward a victim mentality, maybe the reminder is always turned toward experience, because experience is never uniformly bad. Even on that day when my career crashed around me, it was a nice day outside.
That's very cool. I get it. That's really powerful. I like it.
Cool. Glad. Are there other comments or questions we should talk about?
I agree with Stacy. That's very cool. In the midst of possibly losing your, not just your job, but your career, well, the sun is shining. It's not the end of the world.
Oh, look, a bunny.
Yeah, a squirrel.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a golden retriever aspect to living your life that way.
Yeah.
Kim and Stacy and Greg, I very much appreciate you joining us today. I feel a little bit awkward, and you have your participation has made me feel much more comfortable here. One of the traditions that I have at the end of meditation periods, but also at the end of Dharma talks, is to take a moment and to formalize some intention. And if you'll allow me to do that, perhaps we can end with it. What we have been doing for the last few minutes is at trying to bring good into the world. If we have been successful and any good has arisen as a result of this talk, may it be to the benefit of all beings. May we find ways to alleviate suffering around us, suffering or joy more intensely, more clearly, more openly. Thanks for your participation. And I look forward to talking with you further online.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.